happen if instead of composing predetermined assignments, college composition students could compose whatever they want to compose? What would happen if students could set their own deadlines and grade their own work? Find out as Assistant Professor Mason Joyner and I explore these questions with a few of our fellow English department colleagues. I'm Monica Mankin, and this is the English 101 Experiment. Welcome to episode 7.
I was wondering what episode
we
were on.
Yeah, we're on episode 7 now. Mm-hmm. And I'm Monica Mankin, Associate Professor of English at Delgado Community College.
I am Mason Joyner, Assistant Professor of English at Delgado Community College.
I'm Andrew Gibbs, an Assistant Professor of English at Delgado Community College. And number 7... was my jersey number in high school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
What an amazing coincidence.
Serendipity. It's everywhere.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming back on the podcast. I think you were with us for episode 3, where we were sort of skimming the surface of what was happening day to day in our experiment last semester, fall semester of 2023.
Mm. That's how I remember it, episode 3. But skimming the surface may be... Selling is a little short.
Oh, okay.
I think we got some depth.
Okay. You came so prepared last time, too, that we dived right in.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious to talk to y'all about how you go about selecting content for class, what that process mm-hmm. is. I guess, yeah, that's my first question. How do you, like, choose content?
I'll start. Weirdly, I'd never actually, I think, thought of this until this moment, since you're asking me the question, Andrew. I actually think of you a lot when I make this decision. Something you said, I don't know, a couple years ago, probably,
sure.
That you always show your students what you're reading.
I try
right
to.
Now.
Yeah.
And so even if there's like a text that I used to use a lot, but I haven't looked at it in a while, like I try to... If whatever I'm reading, I'm always like, ooh, could I show this to students? And the answer is often no, but, or like, it wouldn't be that useful, right? but whenever I do read something that I was like, oh, this would be great in class, I'm already thinking about, okay, in what context? What would it help to illustrate? What would it help to practice?
Do you find that question as you're like reading something that, you know, that you come across in the wild, does that interfere with your enjoyment of the piece, you know, that your mind immediately goes to work or like, you know, to teaching? Or is that part of the joy of it all?
For me, I think it's part of the joy, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I like when I come across something and I'm like, oh, that would be a great example of metaphor, or like, this would be fun to imitate together in class. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So imitation and metaphor, you know, two examples. I was wondering, like, are there different criteria for the content that you're looking for? Are there different like tiers of content, mm-hmm. you know, that you think about?
Well, I'm not sure if I know what you mean by tiers.
I guess like something you would share, like a quick metaphor, versus something that could work as an anchor text to a larger unit.
Okay, so to speak to this idea, I was just talking to another colleague today about how I don't really have units in the experiment. That's not really how I talk to students about what we're doing or how I'm even conceptualizing what we're doing. I think for me, the criteria that I use, or maybe there's only one criterion, like is this an example of good writing? Mm-hmm. And then from there, it's like, so what about this is good that I want to illustrate or that I want them to practice?
Yeah. I think I would build on that to say, if I come across something that I'm like, ooh, this is really good writing, I guess I'm trying to ask myself, what aspect of good writing is this a great example of?
Mm-hmm. You know? Right.
And of course, I think when I'm reading something, even if I love it, if I feel like it wouldn't work as well out of context of the larger thing that it's in. I don't know, like, so recently I was looking for I was going through all my Alberto Rios books looking for poems for my 206 class, and there are a ton of great Alberto Rios poems that I love, but I'm like, oh, this one doesn't really work as well out of the context of the book. And so I guess I'm looking for texts that can come into class and the enjoyment is barely diminished by not reading the context of this.
So maybe we could speak to a specific example that we both have used in class. Yeah. Jack Gilbert's poem, Failing and Flying, which I actually stole from you and started using. What is it about this poem that you felt like you wanted to share with students?
I think I came across that poem, not in a book, but just on the Poetry Foundation. Back when we first started this other departmental experiment called academic literacy a few years ago.
I think we're still experimenting.
We had talked a lot about as a faculty, we had talked a lot about that Samuel Beckett quote, fail harder, fail again, whatever that quote
is. Fail harder.
Sorry. And so just looking for literary content about failure, I just came across this poem. And I don't know if there was anything aside from the subject matter in it that I was like, ooh, students are going to love this. But students did love it.
They do love it, yes. Yeah. I had the same experience.
And I've had so many class groups really respond to this poem. Yeah.
And I guess what maybe we discovered through our discussion of this poem was that the content, because they love the message. They love not just the greater message of like, you know, failure is sometimes just, to quote the poem, the end of triumph, the end of a triumph. But also that the way that it talks about a relationship, and that's something that I think that they can all relate to. So then that gave us a way to like look at, well, how does this big message get over the plate in just a few lines? And then we start digging into like what's happening with language, which I think is another thing that I definitely am looking for, is like, what can this text teach my students about language?
Yeah. About diction, word choice, or what do you mean by that?
Okay, so that, yes, yeah. Diction, word choice. I think even like syntax. One of the interesting things that happened, so I used this poem, and I also used a poem called Dickhead by Tony Hoagland, which I've used in the past, and I brought it back because I love the way that he talks about how this word helped him access the masculine when he did not feel very masculine as he was growing up. And students had a choice to imitate Failing and Flying or Dickhead, and a lot of students chose Failing and Flying. And one thing I didn't really anticipate was the way that they would struggle, but also embrace the struggle of developing an illusion. Because the poem opens with that illusion to, the line is, everyone forgets that Icarus also flew. And so, like, I saw students, like, researching, like, other Greek myths, and they're trying to, like, kind of find a mythology that fit with what they wanted to be talking about. Like, it just really opened the door to a lot of things that I didn't anticipate, which is also exciting and one of the things that I think I want to keep happening as we use imitation as a tool, as a strategy for generating work.
Yeah.
No, y'all have kind of like touched on a few things that I kind of anticipated in my preparation, that you're looking for texts that are not only good writing alone, but good writing that is about a theme that's universal, that's familiar, that lends itself to additional research, to allowing students to kind of connect those dots and explore, you know, other aspects of Greek mythology. As you mentioned, that's fascinating.
I would only add to that, like, going back to our criteria for selecting texts, you know, I also have to ask myself, is this only interesting to English teachers?
Right.
That's across that bar first, right?
Yeah.
Along those lines, is there something in the text or a piece of content that prevents you from bringing it to class?
In general, but not, I guess there are probably exceptions, but in general, I try to steer clear of religion probably more than anything. I used to steer clear of sex, but I think students actually enjoy talking about sex, and not in like a graphic way, but you know, people talk about it, you know? And so And like there's implications of sex in this poem, failing and flying, you know.
Yeah.
I found myself steering more clear of politics than I used to. Mm-hmm. I used to think, oh, anything current would be good. Mm-hmm. And now I find myself, instead of looking for what's current, it has to be current and timeless.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
tough. And politics in general, I've kind of stayed away from. What about y'all?
Yeah, I agree. I didn't even think about politics as an option because I don't read politics myself, you know.
It's so out that it's not even on your mind.
And I guess I don't think of good writing when I'm thinking about that.
Yeah.
So I'm not like, this is a great article about, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I guess.
Modeling good writing and good thinking to me, so.
Yeah, even if I like see like a good piece on like an analysis of where things stand in Ukraine, I never think, oh, I'll bring this into class.
Yeah, you're
like,
right.
No one's going to care about this. And that's, what is that indicative of? I don't know. Is this good or bad? Should we be, you know, bringing more political content into our class? Or is this an indictment on the state of things? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, what's going on?
Something I'm very conscious of, actually, now that we're talking about it, is I don't want to feed into the misconception that higher education is a brainwashing factory, is a liberal brainwashing factory.
Yeah.
And so I do avoid anything that would even remotely give someone that idea that I'm trying to brainwash them into being a liberal. Mm-hmm. You know?
I think that for me, the subject of English 101 should be writing. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be current events or politics. I mean, those things can come into it because if there's a reason to bring that in there, but I want the focus what we're reading, why we're reading it, to be about writing and demonstrations of good writing, how to think and talk about writing, which leads to some of the other texts that I've been using. And I just ordered this textbook that I think I found where I keep finding these PDFs of things online that I was like, this has to already be in a textbook. And it's called Language Awareness. So I think a lot of people are familiar with Anne Lamott's Shitty First Drafts, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then I was thinking about, well, how do I help my students like build the vocabulary for taking that shitty first draft to like what she calls the updraft, and then the third draft is the dental draft. But how do we talk about revision? And so I remembered this essay that I encountered a long time ago when I first started teaching from Donald Murray called The Maker's Eye. And so we just actually read this in my English 102 today, but my 101 and my Henry class will get it tomorrow. But it's The Maker's Eye, and it's revising your own manuscripts. And so it talks about both like the linear process of writing, but also the recursive process of writing and kind of constantly returning to what you just wrote and fine-tuning and then moving forward with that. And then kind of some concrete things that you can think about to start building that dialogue with yourself, that critical dialogue that I think students need to be able to make choices as writers.
Yeah. Yeah, I read that yesterday when you sent it to me. And I agree. I mean, I'm expecting to give it to my 101 and 110 as well as soon as I can.
I'm curious how y'all implement these new drafts or these new pieces of writing that you're going to study, especially in the context of what Monica mentioned, that her course is unitless. how do you frame the parameters or the boundaries of subject matter as you go through a semester?
Okay, well, so definitely last semester with this experiment, I would say it was definitely unitless. I suppose if we have to delineate things a little bit more this semester, we spent the first 4 weeks because we had that Mardi Gras break there at week five, right? So it's like, what are you going to do for 4 weeks? You know? So that's where we read a couple of poems, and then we read a couple of essays, and then we read an article, and then we listened to a podcast, and we kind of, along the way, we're building our vocabulary about genre. We were imitating. And now we're working on what I'm calling kind of an exploration essay, though I think it's probably more reflective than exploratory. But but the students are kind of reflecting on what they have learned about composition through those first 4 weeks of class. And then they're explaining how they think, or maybe that's where they're exploring, is how they might use what they have learned to help them in the development of the project that they want to compose during the second half of the term. And then we will go through that. We will do the process. There'll be workshops like we had last semester, and then we'll move into, again, another mode, like kind of a phase of self-reflection and evaluation, mm-hmm. right, where we're grading. So I guess, I don't know if that's answering your question, but...
I see how it works, yeah.
Yeah.
Mason? Yeah, I don't really think about delineating the content of what we're studying anymore. I think I used I used to have like text groups,
right.
And every text in that group had something to do with all of the others, right?
Uh-huh.
And I just don't. I crossed that off my worry list. I don't worry about that anymore.
Y'all are so liberated.
I'm
still tied to the module, the anchored of the mm-hmm. of the, you know, central theme and topic.
Yeah.
Well, and I think if you have like an overall course theme with like different units, which I would imagine are defined by the mode mm-hmm. that's being explored there, I get that. I know that we have instructors that do like their unit one has its own theme and mm-hmm. then unit two. And I'm just like, I feel like what are students retaining from mm-hmm. all of this information? And mm-hmm. I just felt like, is there another way to really emphasize the continuity and the progression of what we are doing in this course? Mm-hmm. Where the units felt very much like the students are not registering that, like, mm-hmm. okay, what we're doing these first 4 weeks is to help me with what we're doing during weeks 6 and 7. And then that's preparing me for what I'm doing weeks 8 through 12. And mm-hmm. then, like, I think it's much more clear to them this way, even though mm-hmm. it's just 1 foot in front of the other.
Yeah. Right.
Well, aside from Donald Murray and the Failing and Flying, Jack Gilbert's poem Failing and Flying, what are some of your favorite texts that you're using in your experiment, Monica?
Well, I've used this text for a long time. Mm-hmm. Jamaica Kincaid's The Ugly Tourist, because it's such a great example of making deliberate style decisions. Mm-hmm. And it kind of breaks a lot of the rules that students have been taught over and over again, like... I mean, it's deliberately second person. Also, when you look at it, it's one giant paragraph and then one small paragraph. And like my students were like, where's the introduction? I was like, yeah, that's curious, isn't it? Let's talk about why there might not be that kind of introduction.
Yeah.
And we spent a lot of time breaking this one down before I had them practice imitating some of it. Mm-hmm. Like all the way from like the different elements of style, her diction, her point of view choices, her sentence lengths, all of that. I just asked them to kind of scan it and call out the different punctuation marks that you see. And she uses almost every punctuation mark in the mm-hmm. toolbox. So I just put those up on the board, and then I had students describe to me what's happening with them, like how is it being used. So instead of talking about the rules of a comma, mm-hmm. we're asking ourselves, why is there a comma here? What purpose is it serving? Why is there an M dash? Why does she use an M dash here and not parentheses, which mm-hmm. she has used previously? So we had this like really great critical discussion of punctuation.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had them kind of like practice that, you know, pick something ugly that you want to talk smack about and like, and then give it a try. That was a fun exercise.
When y'all are having these exercises where you're like interrogating a text and asking why,
mm-hmm.
how do you deal with student interpretation? How do you respond to the ways that, you know, students are interpreting the text? Especially when that interpretation is seemingly off base?
Well, I guess following up with, you know, what made you think that?
Right.
Yeah.
Acknowledging everything as even if I privately think, oh, that's a strange reading, like
uh-huh.
acknowledging that it came from somewhere.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about where it came from.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's been on my mind a lot, and even... my English 205 class, I've been surprised by some of the interpretations or where the sympathies are aligned with characters who mm-hmm. I thought were, you know, clearly, you know, not to be admired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're right. It is like based on this like personal experience. So I've been trying to remind students to like return to the author's intent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, what is their intention? You know, more so.
Which is
than,
impossible
like,
to know sometimes at least, right?
Maybe.
Maybe I'm thinking more in terms of poetry. I mean,
yeah.
sometimes, like, what was the author trying to do here? We can speculate.
We can speculate.
But anyway.
Yeah.
But I think I like the idea of, I mean, yeah, if somebody's kind of way out there
you know, you want to rein them in. But mm-hmm. I think part of what, and this came up even in 102 with the Maker's Eye, this like the possibilities of meaning are so great, and yeah. that mm-hmm. just engaging with those possibilities is really, I think, an important activity for students. And students seem to feel like it's okay to like shout out whatever came to mind, but no, I'm going to ask you a follow-up question, like, right. you know, show me in the text, or can you elaborate on that? Or yeah. even just sometimes I'm like, what do you mean by that? You yeah. know, and kind of try to draw out what they're thinking. Yeah. And not settle for the initial blurt. Right.
you know? Yeah.
Mason, will you talk about, because we did different things during our first four weeks of the semester. So will you talk about what you've been doing?
Yeah, I brought in two texts that I had been wanting to bring into a class for so long and never had. For their first composition project, and this was kind of a reactionary thing for me after last semester, the first time we did the experiment, feeling like I didn't effectively set a standard of rigor early on. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to start off with a project that was a little more guided, a little more structured, and set a tone for some rigor. And so we read two pieces, two pretty different pieces. One is called Creative Eating, The Oreo Syndrome, a sociology paper by Elizabeth Adler. And then the other was a short story by Laurie Moore called A Mall and the Night Visitors. And in their first project, they were able to imitate one of those two pieces in whatever they want, you know, at that point, as long as it's imitating one of these two pieces. And we spent most of our class time talking about what that means and analyzing the text for strategies to imitate this author, strategies to imitate this author, looking at punctuation, looking at the way that they, the way that Laurie Moore like really inventively describes things.
Yeah.
I think by and large, I mean, I don't think I've talked to any of the students that didn't enjoy the short story. it has a great first line. First line of the story is, "Understand that your cat is a whore and can't help you." And they loved it. They, uh-huh. when we sat down to it, a few of them glanced at the first line and said, "Read the first line aloud." I said, "Okay, yeah, but,
they told you to read the first line. They just wanted to hear you say whore.
They just wanted to hear me say it. Yeah. So we've now moved beyond that. They workshopped their first drafts all together. So the people who imitated Adler workshopped their drafts together. The people who imitated Moore workshopped their drafts together. And then in our, you know, second conference checkpoint, I'm looking at now their second draft of that project. So that's what we've done in the first 5 or 6 weeks.
It's awesome.
Yeah,
that's
and awesome. I'll be interested to compare notes. So my students are drafting out this exploration essay. And tomorrow we're going to work on blending source language. So mm-hmm. we read Procrastinators Rejoice, mm-hmm. an online article about, I think, both sides of, you know, the sure. benefits and costs of procrastination, which was then followed by the podcast Plain English, thanks to Andrew here, The Science of Procrastination. And I think I'm going to use the worksheet that you created, Mason, mm-hmm. that has the examples of where in Procrastinators Rejoice, they citing the sources, mm-hmm. but have them choose a different text, maybe one that they want to cite in their actual essay to do mm-hmm. some imitation of like blending source language.
Right.
Which I think is like such a great way to help them break out of that, according to.
Yeah.
Trying to be a little more selective and just, yeah. It's so pretty when a selective quote has been inserted almost, you know, naturally into your own sentence. Uh-huh. That's a good skill.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Mason, you mentioned rigor, mm-hmm. and rigor and mercy have been our department.
Like hard rock band.
Coda. Yeah. Uh-huh. Have you settled on rigor? Is that the right word? I have a...
Oh, you have a bone to
pick with
rigor?
I have a nomination.
I'm more interested in your nomination.
Yeah, what's the nomination?
I think instead of rigor and mercy, mm-hmm. what we're talking about is gravitas and levity.
Ah.
What do you think about this? Am I on the right track, or is this too... precocious or something.
Processing it. Gravitas.
Gravitas and levity.
I mean, I really like the idea of levity, right? Like, we all need to lighten up.
Why gravitas and not gravity?
Gravity is something that happens in the atmosphere. Gravitas is more of an aura. I don't know. Gravity is too scientific.
Yeah. So what is gravitas? Like in the classroom, what is gravitas, Andrew?
I think it's reverence. I think it's like, you know, what we're doing is important and, you know, deserves our respect and our time and our commitment.
Yeah.
I like that because then I think the standards follow from that, right?
Yeah.
Rigor does sound like death, like rigor mortis.
It's the word itself.
Yeah. You know, the word you just used that I really love is reverence.
Reverence.
And I feel like you know, we talk about language so much. Like, we talk about punctuation in the classroom, and again, just looking at word choice and things, treating language with reverence, I think, is something that is very important to me and something I try to bring into the classroom.
I love that.
Treating language reverently.
Words matter. Yeah.
Right. And understanding that relationship then to thought, right? Like, that these are your thoughts that you're representing here, and probably you should care about them.
Right.
Yeah, I like that. I don't know if it's going to make quite the poster that Rigor and Mercy made.
Yeah. Well, illustrations aside,
yeah,
I think we decided that gravitas and levity were better. I got one example here. This is an essay that I read a few years ago and immediately struck me as, you know, something worth teaching in class or studying in class. And I never got around to it for one reason or another, but I'm trying to revive it. And before I unveil it in front of the students, maybe I can run it across y'all and just get a couple of, you know, words of advice. This was written in 2021. It's called "I Fell in Love with Motorcycles, But Could I Ever Love Sturgis?" Sturgis, South Dakota.
Okay.
Where there's a big motorcycle rally.
Okay.
And so there's one line that I want to read for you.
Please.
And then I would just like to hear how you would use this piece of content in class, or what you would do with it. Okay. "She spoke in a tone of mischief, not confrontation, the, oh, you're bad, of the third margarita. Everyone was in the outlaw spirit, preparing to hit the open road in the lawless territory where Wild Bill Hickok was shot, a state with no adult helmet laws." And that's all for now. Do you want to hear it again?
Well, the first thing that strikes me is the voice.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
It's driven by a very clear voice.
Yeah.
And I think that just talking about then, well, what is creating that voice? And like being able to break that down just with that alone. What elements of style are creating this voice that we hear? Mm-hmm. What are the choices this writer's made?
Yeah.
And then trying to emulate that yourself to cultivate a particular voice, or the voice that's invoked here? Or
if they want to try to emulate that voice, or if they want to choose a different voice, right? Like, that voice is kind of capturing like the lawlessness that it's talking about, right? And it's setting a tone. And so it's like, if students think of a different situation, I would maybe have them think about other situations that you could sort of describe. And then what style choices would you make to capture that tone or that voice related to that situation?
Yeah.
That's fascinating, because I didn't think about voice at all.
Ah.
What did you think about?
Yeah.
Well, both of y'all are so much more creative and artistic than I am. And I think that I'm more analytical. And so I look at it, and I'm just like, the outlaw spirit, underline that. Uh-huh. And then it's just like, what is the outlaw spirit? Define it.
Uh-huh.
What's appealing about it? And then trying to, like, you know, put students in, you know, would you want to be an outlaw? Mm. In what context? Why? What would you be outlawed, you know, from doing? Or, you know, what do you want to be an outlaw, you know, from, I guess?
Yeah. And the outlaw spirit, you know, of course, assuming a definition of it, the outlaw spirit to me seems like something at the very center of American identity.
That's my third note. Right? This is an American concept.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it still an American concept?
I mean, the American Revolution, a bunch of outlaws saying, hell no, you know.
Right. And so.
So for you, it's more of a content, like idea engagement, right?
Yeah.
That's great.
That's great, too.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it is.
That's
great, too.
Well, like Monica has said, I think on the podcast or maybe just in the hallway that we teach who we are.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's something we've talked about a lot is I can't teach anyone else, you know, even if someone else is a great teacher, I can't just do what they do.
Yeah.
That's not me.
No.
Yeah. And it's not going to be as good coming out of my mouth.
Yeah, those topics aren't going to work the same. Mm-hmm. Piece may not work as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
Which is why, like, you know, I mean, if people are interested in trying what we are trying, like, you've got to go with what speaks to you as these examples and these models and the things that you that you have passion about and that inspire you.
Yeah.
That's where the gravitas comes back in.
Sure, the gravitas.
You can't fake gravitas.
Exactly. Yeah, if you don't feel it, the gravitas of it, then no one else will. Yeah.
All of a sudden, you're in outer space. Yeah, exactly.
Now we're back to gravity.
You're probably back to gravity. Yeah. Thank you.
I was reminded Dr. Isaac Brumfield, something that he used to tell me that he would do in his English 102 classes is have them draw a line down the center of the paper and, you know, write whatever it is your sentence you're working on, write the sentence that goes in your research paper here. And now on the other side, write it again like you were just talking to your mother. Just as a way of, I guess, simplifying language, you know, not trying to sound academic.
How you think you're supposed to sound.
Right, how you think you're supposed to sound.
Yeah.
But also, I think there's a lot of voice play in that kind of exercise as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the rhetorical decisions you make based on audience. Yeah.
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 Well, it's time. So, do we have any final thoughts to wrap us up today?
I'm pretty pleased. Y'all are great.
We're great too.
Thanks for having me back.
I mean, it's just fun to talk to
it is.
People about what they do because even though you might not do exactly what I'm doing, maybe, you know, and I know I'm going to be thinking about outlaw spirit.
Yeah.
Now, don't blame me when you get, arrested.
I don't know if I'm going to take it that far.
Okay.
Something about this episode that I really enjoyed is how excited we all get about the texts, that we're teaching.
Yeah.
Because we're teaching them because we love them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's all.
That's the number one criterion, right? It's like you have to care about it first and then maybe someone else in your class will care about it. Yeah. Maybe.
All right. Well, thank you, Andrew, for joining us again.
My pleasure.
And
thank you, listener. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the English 101 Experiment. Special thanks to Christopher Nicotera, instructor of music business at Delgado Community College, for his recording assistance. All music heard during this episode comes from the Free Music Archive. Specific titles and artists are listed on the English 101 Experiment website.